Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today, no surprise. First, a long interview with NYU professor Nikhil Pal Singh on race, class, policing, and protest. And then Michael Kanukin of New York City DSA will review the election results in that part of the world earlier this week. Before that, a few words on the economic situation. On Thursday morning, the Labor Department announced that just under 1.5 million people filed for unemployment insurance under the regular program last week, and another 728,000 filed under a special pandemic program, which covers people normally outside the system, like freelancers. These numbers are well off their peaks, which prompted some enthused commentary about how things may be finally turning around, but they're still extremely high by historical standards. The combined regular and special pandemic figures are over 3 times the pre-COVID high. The number of people drawing benefits as of the previous week, the most recent available, was just under 20 million, and another 11 million were drawing under the pandemic program. That's 17 times the number that were getting unemployment checks at the end of February, before all hell broke loose. It's fair to say the economy has stabilized to some degree, but that's a long way from saying it's turning around. Earlier this week, the IMF released a gloomy set of forecasts for the global economy that were considerably weaker than what they were saying as recently as April. The recovery is likely to be slow, and there are still many risks out there, even if COVID behaves, which it isn't in countries like Brazil and Russia, and also in about 20 U.S. states. As the IMF notes in its characteristically understated way, the extent of the recent rebound in financial market sentiment appears disconnected from shifts in underlying economic prospects, raising the possibility that financial conditions may tighten more than assumed. In other words, the insane rally in global stock markets, prompted by investor optimism and trillions in magic central bank money, could come undone, leading to more trouble in what finance types call the real sector, that of production and work. We need more fiscal stimulus in the short term and a large infrastructure and redistribution program of the sort outlined by the Green New Deal in the long term. We may get a weak version of the short-term program in the coming months, but for the long term, we'll need a serious political restructuring. Enough of me. Weeks of massive protests, which are ebbing but hardly over, have totally transformed the landscape. The scale of the protests, their popularity, and the speed of the shift in the political discourse can make heads spin uncontrollably. Here to set this all in historical and theoretical context is Nikhil Pal Singh. He's a professor of social and cultural analysis and history at NYU and directs its prison education program. His book, Race and America's Long War, published in 2017 by the University of California Press, looks at social hierarchies at home and their relationship to our long, bloody history of imperial war. His work is an excellent antidote to all his annoying disputes about identity versus class, because, as we'll hear, all those issues are deeply bound up with each other. Nikhil Pal Singh. Since you've spent an awful lot of time writing and thinking about the role of the police in enforcing a racialized social order in the U.S., what do you make of the explosion that we've seen over the last few weeks and the degree of popular support it seems to have with no precedent?
Yeah, I would agree with that characterization. I think it's a moment that we have probably been, could say we've been working for a long time, at least 10 years, those who have been protesting against American police violence. I don't think we expected, I never expected to see this level of an upsurge. Of course, it's not all due to the police issue. I mean, I think it's arising out of a whole range of social circumstances we're facing right now, which I'm sure we could get into. But I think it's hard not to look at this moment and the scope and scale and breadth of popular initiative and not be heartened by it if you're on the left, or even if you're interested in liberal reform of institutions that have become exceedingly oppressive even by mainstream liberal standards. So from that standpoint, I'm heartily in favor. I think we have things to be concerned about in terms of how this will ultimately play out politically and whether we will get the kinds of change that we need from this kind of protest, because obviously we've seen people in the streets in the United States in great numbers over the last 20 years protesting against terrible things that have still come to pass. And, you know, I think our politics, our collective politics is broken, And that's also partly what we're seeing. So all of us who have been thinking about this for a long time have been trying to imagine what the way forward is. Clearly, this is part of it, but it's not going to lead us to where we need to go.
Now, the political reaction has been very surprising in the broader establishment politics. You know, you've got the New York City Council talking about cutting $1 billion out of the police budget. We've seen polls showing high levels of approval among even the white population. What's different about it now? That are we just growing up finally, or the breadth of the upsurge is pushing people? What do you attribute this to?
It's curious. I do think that the 40-year law and order project that built the massive American prison complex and that grew police forces and municipal police budgets and militarized them and made them harsher has been something that ordinary people have seen across the political spectrum and certainly across race and ethnic lines, although the disproportion of where the force and violence is concentrated is also clear. So I think we've been prepared for this moment for a long time, or preparing for this moment. I mean, the conversation about criminal justice reform and decarceration has been going on, like I said, for at least 10 years. And of course, a lot of this began to explode during the Obama presidency with the Trayvon Martin shooting, with Ferguson, with the incremental efforts the Obama administration made to decriminalize some nonviolent drug offenses and to begin the process of reducing the prison population at the federal level. That's also been going on at the state level in New York State, where there's been a push for decarceration for a long time. So I think even Trump, the one thing that Trump has sort of latched onto that wasn't a reaction against liberals in general, was the criminal justice reform initiative. So even Trump, even the Trump administration has wanted to be somewhat connected to the idea that our policing and carceral project has been a failed policy. So I think there's been a lot of preparation for the public to have a kind of consensus around that issue. So I think we have to put what's happened in that broader frame.
Now, of course, the figure of Trump is very important here. We saw the initial rise of Black Lives Matter under a Black president, a Black attorney general, I believe a Black Homeland Security secretary, too. You know, now Trump obviously plays racial rhetoric with considerable skill and violence. What is the contribution of that shift from that kind of liberal multicultural veneer that Obama provided to the naked violence of Trump rhetoric?
I think that's been a tough question for all of us. You know, I think we've been trying to take the measure of this moment since 2016. Is Trump a weak president? Is he a harbinger of fascism? You know, is this a moment of the upsurge of a kind of long history of white supremacy? Is this the death spasms of the long history of white supremacy? I tend probably to shade more to the idea that Trump is a weak president, and that we are in the death spasms of a kind of older model of white supremacy, and that in some ways he, because again of a range of pretty complicated and kind of lucky circumstances, was able to hack this moment to sort of bring back a revanchist discourse that maybe is going to once again fade away with Trump as the Republican Party turns back to a kind of aggressive civic nationalism as a much more and a kind of dog whistle sort of subterranean appeal to constituencies that it understands to be invested in a kind of racist politics. But racist politics has diminishing returns in American life, and even within Trump's oeuvre, I would argue, anti-Black racist themes have been more muted than the anti-immigrant and kind of anti-China themes. And even if you go back to the Bush administration, I mean, the Bush administration, the W. Bush administration, was really trying to produce the GOP as a big tent. They had a big multicultural roster of people prosecuting the war on terror. Their animus was much more outwardly directed towards the figure of the Islamic terrorist, the Muslim terrorist. This is a kind of a project that's seeking an enemy. You know, there's been a long search to kind of restore a stable object of nemesis, you know, within the framework of GOP politics. And the Trump project turned it back inwards, which was a very dangerous thing. You know, it's one thing to fight a war over there, you know, but when you turn it inwards, when you turn the rhetoric of war and violence inwards, it's tremendously destabilizing. And I think it's had us all on edge. And I think that it's ultimately something that is cannibalizing itself before our eyes. So that would be sort of my answer today. I do think that this is not the easiest thing to pin down. And I think that the truth is that the liberal multiculturalist veneer, as you called it, and the kind of revanchist, more aggressive kind of racist edge, which has always been part of the GOP, you know, since the Reagan era, these have been kind of symbiotic in our politics. They don't exactly ever come to a full sort of opposition, right? I mean, these are two factions that can nonetheless find it quite easy to agree on defense policy, on war making, on tax policy, on deregulation, you know, on a whole range of things, right? Even getting tough on crime was sort of handed off from Reagan to Clinton. We have to really understand this as a kind of, it's become kind of the matrix of our politics, and we're still looking for a way to break through it to a more just settlement, a settlement that actually brings us racial justice, not just multicultural diversity, you know, and a settlement that brings us kind of full inclusion and equality and support for the economically disfranchised and disadvantaged, right? And not just a kind of token diversity that serves upwardly mobile, kind of upwardly distributive policies. So we're caught in that way. We have two devils that we've been fighting, right, for a long time. And I think it's really confused people on the left. And it's been really hard to hold to a ground where we can retain a commitment to racial justice that is robust and at the same time sort of pursue what I think is always the hallmark of a left project, which is a universalist project of economic redistribution.
It's been amazing to watch corporate America endorse Black Lives Matter in recent weeks.
Exactly.
I mean, you've got Jamie Dimon talking about structural racism.
It's wild.
What do you make of this?
It's wild, you know. I mean, I think it was like in compulsive lockstep. Every single major corporation had their statement. And, you know, I watch Amazon Prime, and the first thing you see across that screen is Amazon. You know, Amazon supports Black Lives Matter. You know, and meanwhile, you know, we live in New York City, and the essential workers who are doing the logistics and the delivery and the grocery checkout, they're all working pretty much for Amazon these days. The vast majority of them are living in the outer boroughs. A lot of them are Black and Latino, and that's really where most New Yorkers have died during this period.
Black lives matter, but don't ask us to pay for them.
And certainly we don't want to take all the extra measures we need to protect and support our Black and brown workers who are actually making our corporation the most fabulously wealthy corporation in human history. It is a disjuncture, and there's no way not to notice it. Having said that, you know, I don't necessarily want to overread that either. I mean, corporations are also worried about the fact that you have mass action in the street around this issue. They want to get in front of this so that they can be part of the agencies that are basically going to tell us what police reform actually means. It's cynical in more than one sense, right? You could say it's a distraction from like the bottom line that they really care about, you know, and that's one kind of shallow left reading of what that means and that it's not sincere. Or you could say that it's these corporations recognizing something about this moment and realizing that they have to be out in front of it and they have to be part of the conversation so that it doesn't go in a direction that is too radical for them. Because the thing is that police reform in urban areas is something that actually is going to start to tread on a lot of issues that affect Amazon's bottom line if it goes in the direction that many of us want it to go.
I'm speaking with the NYU professor, Nikhil Paul Singh. For a long time, it seemed like the American ruling class had gotten kind of lazy without any significant political challenge to speak of. And now we see the rise of socialism in the public discourse, and then this broad rebellion over the last month or two. It seems like they have to wake up and get ahead of things for a change.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how they can keep outsourcing government to these dummies, you know? I mean, the thing about American corporations, whatever you want to say about them, you know, they know how to run operations. You know, they know how to do ideology. They know how to plan. They know how to allocate resources. Corporate liberalism is, you know, been the great achievement in many ways of the whole post World War II period of the history of the United States, and in many ways it's still going strong. But then you look at the governing elite in this country, it's a shock to sort of consider these people who are running the country. Now, obviously, part of this is by design to kind of make the parts of the state that actually serve the interests of the masses of people, the regulatory state that makes sure that we have clean water, they want that to fail because of a kind of ideology that has sort of gone to the point where it leads us to calamity. But I don't know how long corporations can sort of do the act where they continue to support that. It seems like they're going to be much happier to have a kind of neoliberal progressive back in office. But I think even there, I think they're miscalculating the depth of the rot in what the American state has become. So I don't know what ways corporations these days are actually thinking about the governing project. Or if they're thinking about the governing project, and maybe they can't. Maybe they too are kind of locked into a situation where, you know, they don't actually have an answer to how to produce a different kind of settlement.
This question of Trump and fascism is a vexing one. First of all, do you think it's useful to try to answer that question? You know, but second of all, look at Hitler didn't take over and run Germany until he had the backing of big capital.
That's right.
What we were just describing was a schism between the people around Trump and really the larger Republican Party and big capital right now. Mm-hmm. Is this a fascist or pre-fascist moment? Is that a useful thing to think about? How do we classify Trump?
Personally, Trump probably is a fascist in the sense that his politics and his predilections run in that direction. You know, I think he's interested in manipulating the public. I think he has no lines, really, that he wouldn't cross. I think he has deep racial animus that kind of runs through his thinking about the U.S. and the world that is real. But I don't think we have fascism. You know, we don't have a fascist government. We still have the corrupt and sclerotic American constitutional form that has presided over every period of atrocity in American history, from Indian removal to the Red Scare, so, you know, to mass incarceration. So we didn't really need fascism to have all of those episodes. But, you know, I think you're asking a really interesting question about whether fascism in a more sort of general sense is merely on hold right now. In other words, is it one of the potential paths in our political future? Because if what I've been saying sort of in this, you know, in this perhaps at times a little bit abstract way in this conversation so far, we've been in a protracted crisis that's looking for a settlement, that's looking for some kind of resolution. Bernie represents one kind of path or represented one kind of path. I think we've underestimated just how resilient those kind of third way neoliberals actually are within the Democratic Party, and they're potentially very likely to be back in charge in early 2021. Which way does the GOP actually go? And do we see something that takes a much more competent and kind of scary form under a better organized administration under the leadership of Tom Cotton or Josh Hawley, you know, or something like that? I don't really know, you know, and I don't tend to be kind of staying up at night afraid of that eventuality. But I do think that there's a lot to be worried about as our political crisis continues and as the inability to achieve a kind of settlement that resolves the underlying both destructive incapacities of the American state, deepening wealth polarization, and the kind of next round of crises that we can expect, whether they are crises on the order of another pandemic or what are surely to be another rolling wave of environmentally induced or ecologically induced crises. How do we hold up to that? You know, and what comes along next to try to promise us a resolution to those crises? I mean, there's no reason to think that we are beyond another big war happening, you know, and there's no reason to think that we couldn't have a much more competent and politically popular authoritarian solution that emerged in those conditions if they got worse. So I don't think it's irrelevant or wrong or meaningless to talk about fascism and to think about how it exists out there in the repertoire of possibilities in our political future.
Although bringing that word in makes it sound like an import, and Trump and the American right, you know, have deep roots.
Right. I mean, in a way, that's where I started in my answer to you, right? Which is to say that, you know, Langston Hughes, the great African-American poet, used to talk about our native fascisms during World War II. And he was basically talking about the U.S. South and Jim Crow. And if fascism emerges in the United States, it will take an American form. I don't get too wrapped up in the Trump as fascist debate, really. I mean, I do think there's a validity to thinking about the elective affinities of a kind of politics that interests Trump and the afterlives, what I've called the afterlives of fascism. I think those are latent potentials all throughout our politics. And whether it takes on the really dangerous form of a mass fascism is something that seems more remote to me at this point.
And one of your themes has been the relation between American domestic politics and imperial war abroad. Trump likes to make some bellicose sounds, but he's probably killed fewer people than his predecessor. He disappointed John Bolton by canceling a raid against Iran. What about this absence of really overt imperial war? What does this do to our domestic politics?
Well, I think Trump has done a lot of drone strikes, and obviously we still have the empire. You know, we still have the empire of bases, and there isn't necessarily a winding down of those capabilities. So something like fascism, we may just be on hold in that sense. Trump hasn't fully broken with those institutional legacies, obviously, because he's very interested in advertising himself as an America first. I've rebuilt our military. It's the strongest military on earth, blah, 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 blah. So I wouldn't oversell the sort of Trump as non-interventionist. He's a kind of America first militarist who came into office in a moment where we'd had decades of failure of American foreign policy through these wars of choice and these kind of adventurous politics overseas. I mean, Obama himself was trying to wind those down. The mood is anti-war. The mood, because in part of how deteriorated our own social fabric has become, is sort of inwardly focused on the problems at home. But in many ways, what Trump has done is he's, I think, activated what I call the discourse of the inner war, the idea that we don't fight wars against external enemies. We actually have enemies inside the country that we have to root out. And that inner war discourse has always been part of the American right. It's always been about kind of racial enemies and enemies infiltrating over the border, enemies who are characterized by the deviousness of their thought, which is essentially kind of right-wing anti-communism. And I think Trump really draws on those legacies. So if anything, the bellicosity has become more, as I said earlier, inwardly focused and has kind of had everybody on edge for the last several years. You're absolutely right that Trump has killed fewer people. I mean, and there's no way the monstrosity of the Trump administration, as bad as it is, compares to the monstrosity of the George W. Bush administration. This is the one part of Trump's legacy that we have to actually hold on to. We have to really figure out how we can turn a kind of break from American militarism and interventionism into something that is durable going forward and that is not channeled into an inwardly focused bellicosity, but that's actually channeled into what it might mean to cultivate our garden.
I'm speaking with the NYU professor Nikhil Pal Singh. To conclude, I'd like to turn to something you said on Twitter the other day. Important text on Twitter. The failure to take into account class-differentiated racism creates errors of perception and judgment on both sides, a denial of racism on class grounds and an inflation of racism on race grounds. Could you expand on that?
I could expand on that at length.
I figured you could, yeah.
I hope that people go into the conversation and try to read through it. It's a challenging argument to hold on to, especially in the space of Twitter and social media. By talking about class-differentiated racism, what I'm trying to point to is the idea that we live in a world in which the kind of racialized violence that is being visited mostly upon the Black poor, which has been central to the uprisings that we've seen and the mass protests that we've seen over the last several weeks and over the last decade, also gets channeled into a lot of proxy fights that happen within newsrooms, that happen within universities, that happen within professional settings, and that happen around arguments that suggest this or that space isn't racially diverse or inclusive enough. Once it becomes the argument about racial inclusion and diversity in professional spaces, it is not the same fight as the fight around police killing poor people of color in segregated neighborhoods. It's just not the same thing. But in our mediated world, these become connotatively resonant with one another. So you get a situation in which the energy and anger that derives from a video of a policeman kneeling on a Black man's neck while he doesn't resist for 9 minutes with a total indifference to that person's life can be carried over into a charge that somebody who expresses some more casual racial, say, animus, or even something that's just interpreted as a casual racial animus, is treated with the same kind of level of intensity. That's what I mean about the inflation of racism, right? It's not that we're not watching the most egregious kind of racism, but the class-differentiated nature of it when we miss it allows it to morph and move in ways that I think, as I said, lead to kind of a kind of undifferentiated judgment where we don't actually see the difference between different kinds of things. Similarly, we might say that in order to really understand the efficacy of these protests and why they're so important, we have to recognize something of the class character of Black suffering in the United States. We can't simply talk about these as instances of a kind of racialized legacy. The thing that will most likely determine whether you have a police encounter or whether you end up in prison in the United States is whether you have a high school diploma or not. Of course, these phenomena are racially and spatially defined by residential segregation and by long histories of how people have been organized along racial lines. But plenty of white people are killed by the police, and plenty of white people are ending up in prison. And if anything, the rates of incarceration are going up in rural red state America right now. And that's partly due to the opioid crisis. And some people might say that the opioid crisis was treated with more sympathy because it involved white people. But you look at the actual policies in states like Alabama, which have been super hard hit by the opioid crisis, and the response is the same. It's criminal, punitive sanction. It's putting people in prison. Partly what Black Lives Matter allows us to see is that, of course, Black Lives Matter, but also that Black lives not mattering has actually been part of what allowed the production of a malevolent state and economy that has a general impact. That's what I always took to be the great lesson of the Black freedom movement over time, that it was about a general democratizing project, you know? And I think that we've lost sight of that tradition in the way in which we tend to focus on racial disparity in a way that narrows the discussion rather than brings it out to a kind of broader set of insights and understandings. So my argument is not that we don't take racial disparity seriously. We do take racial disparity seriously, but we understand it within this kind of wider frame, and we understand how race and class shoot through each other in the United States. They imbricate, they embroider one another. They become embedded together. We, in some ways, are forced into using two different languages, a language of race and a language of class, but we actually have to try to keep them much, much closer in the way in which we think and act if we are going to actually produce the kind of politics that overcomes the impasse that we often find ourselves in this moment.
But then on the other side, you get the class first crowd. It says, you know, it's a slippery slope to neoliberalism if you talk about racial justice.
Exactly. And I think that I'm not making that argument. I mean, I think the class first cloud, the class first crowd, try to say that 10 times, they sort of make an inverse error, right? Which is that they don't understand or see how class differentiated racism is not just about middle class black people who are professionals crying racism on Twitter, right? But class-differentiated racism is also about the way in which the working class that is so beloved of the class-first argument is itself racially differentiated and segmented into the employed and the unemployed, into people who have different kinds of occupational access, into people who are forced to live in different parts of the city with different access to good transportation, good schools, good social services or not, right? So there's a whole history in which, as you know, Stuart Hall, the great Black British Marxist put it, or I guess one-time Marxist put it, race is the modality in which classes live. There's a reason why it is so difficult to demystify the racist forms in which we have come to live and understand differences among people who actually share many of the same economic circumstances. So the class first argument doesn't show much interest, really, in some ways, in that material history. Racism is not just an ideological form, it's a lived reality. So I think that that's where that argument fails, and it doesn't allow us to understand some of the ways in which we live through a period in which the working class itself has been recomposed. It's not the industrial working class, it's a different working class. And it's a working class that is very fractured by race and gender and space and occupation and full employment and underemployment and carceral status and documented status. All of these things are part of what the American working class is. And so if you're not talking seriously about the racialized histories and formations within the working class, you're not actually doing the work of building the kind of solidarity that this class-first argument professes to want to produce when it says we have to stop talking about racism so that we can produce solidarity.
That was Nikhil Pal Singh, professor of social and cultural analysis and history at NYU and director of its prison education program. His most recent book, Race in America's Long War, was published in 2017 by the University of California Press. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of the second movement of the Sextet for Strings No. 1 by Johannes Brahms, performed by the Amadeus Quartet. And now I hope you'll indulge me a little provincialism, though I think it's of larger than purely regional interest. New York held a primary election, a hard thing to do these days when everyone's afraid of going outside, on Tuesday, the 23rd. Results are inconclusive since there are so many absentee ballots that won't be counted for a week or more, but it looks like the electoral left did very well. Two stars, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and State Senator Julia Salazar, were reelected by crushing margins, so large that the absentees couldn't affect them. Jamal Bauman, a middle school principal who grew up poor, looks to have beaten a 30-year incumbent, Elliot Engel, who was endorsed by the Democratic establishment. And it looks like several left candidates for the state legislature also won. Many of these candidates were supported by the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, although DSA was far from the only organized support behind them. Here to analyze what it all means is Michael Kanukin, a member of Brooklyn DSA's Electoral Working Group and a stellar Facebook political pundit. I should disclose that I'm a member of DSA, but held off on doing an interview like this during the campaign, lest it look like electioneering. These electoral victories are of broad political importance regardless of my affiliations. They're a sign of where things are heading, and also whole lessons for leftists doing electoral work across the country. Michael Kanukin. Give us the rundown on how New York DSA did yesterday.
It was a really exciting night for us. As you may know, there are many, many absentee ballots left to count, to the point where we believe that the vote totals from election night may represent less than half of the total vote. But that said, New York City DSA had two incumbents up last night, AOC and Julia Salazar, and they both won really crushing definitive victories on a night where other incumbents didn't do quite as well. So we're really proud of that. And then we had one new state Senate candidate for an open seat in central Brooklyn, Jabari Brisport, who is well ahead in the election day voting and who shows every indication he's going to win. We also had three assembly candidates, Zoran Mamdani in Astoria, Marcela Mitenez in Sunset Park, and then Farah Souffrant-Forest in Crown Heights, Prospect Heights. Of those, Zoran is well ahead on election night. Farah is very slightly behind and may well come up ahead when all the votes are counted. Marcella is a bit farther behind in a four-way race, but there is still hope, and we're going to make sure every vote is counted. And finally, we had a congressional challenger for an open seat with a very, very split field, Samalise Lopez. And she does not appear to have won. That seat looks like it's going to go to Richie Torres. But she did very, very respectably for a newcomer. And it's a race we're really, really proud of because DSA has really established itself as a coalition partner in the Bronx and built alliances and connections that we're going to carry forward into the next year.
What was DSA's role with Jamal Bauman?
That's a great question. So I'm in New York City DSA. Lower Hudson DSA endorsed Bauman quite late in the race a couple weeks ago, and National DSA also endorsed him. In that situation, our members were part of a much larger coalition, prominently featuring Justice Democrats and the Working Families Party, as well as many others. And our members were really proud to stand with them. From the results last night, it looks as though Jamal Bauman and Mondaire Jones will be the two congressmen from Westchester. So all of Westchester, almost all of Westchester, other than the Sean Patrick Maloney slice, will be represented by really strong progressive Black candidates who proudly support Medicare for All and a Green New Deal. So we're really excited about that.
So how did this happen? This is, you know, impressive results. What does it all mean?
It means the progressive infrastructure, you know, inside DSA and also more broadly is really scaling up really impressively. I think a lot of people looked at the 2018 results in New York City when many, you know, IDC members were defeated, and DSA, of course, had two very, very long shot challenges, which both won, Julia Salazar and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. A lot of people looked at that and said, well, AOC and Julia both took lazy incumbents by surprise. They'll be ready next time. And then, you know, the IDC thing, I mean, in that case, Democrats were literally caucusing with Republicans during the Trump administration. They're special, exceptional, and separate. You'd be a fool to think this is going to keep happening going forward. I even heard from a number of people, especially on the left, who said that, you know, even though AOC and Julia had gotten in this time, the machine would be coming for them next time, and they would have a much tougher time. What we've seen is that these seats that DSA took in 2018, DSA-backed candidates took in 2018, are not going anywhere. Their districts love these candidates, and they did very well against machine-backed opponents. And then I think what else we're seeing is that these were not a flash in the pan, that like the Democratic voting base is very, very dissatisfied with the hacks and real estate funded candidates who represent too many districts in New York City, and that really incumbents are vulnerable across the city because they don't represent what their constituents want to see. I would throw in that it's really hard to tell at this point what turnout looks like compared to 2018, but 2018 turnout was spectacularly high relative to past elections, and that appears to have stayed true in 2020. So there are a lot of newly mobilized and politicized people out there.
And of course, this election was conducted under extremely bizarre circumstances.
Yes, that's certainly true. DSA's key strength as an electoral operation has always been our commitment to face-to-face voter contact and real organizing conversations with voters. We've never been an organization that relies on flashy messaging or tons of campaign mail. It's always been about volunteers talking to their neighbors. And this year, we couldn't do that. You know, we phone banked very, very intensively, but it's not the same as that face-to-face. And frankly, it's just, you can't talk to a good chunk of voters because there just aren't phone numbers available for them. So we really ran this cycle with what I think is our key advantage handicapped. And the fact that we still did incredibly well is something I'm really proud of. The day before the election, I was preparing myself to lose everywhere and to just know that the circumstances we were running under were incredibly tough for us. And thank goodness that didn't happen. It speaks to, I just think in a normal year, we would have won these races by a wide margin.
Wall Street and real estate interests poured a lot of money into AOC's challenger and got nowhere.
Yeah. The way I always phrase it is that there are really steeply declining returns to money spent on campaigns, that it's really, really important to have enough money to hire good staff and to print lit and so forth. But after that, if you don't have a message that any sane voter is interested in hearing, then putting that bad message on your 12th mailer just is not going to be effective. Julia and AOC really showed that quite clearly.
The process you describe, when DSA endorses a candidate, it's not just a formality. I mean, it involves the devotion of a lot of human resources. I think a lot of people don't get that when they complain about DSA's refusal nationally to endorse Joe Biden, right? Could you explain what that all means?
Yeah, absolutely. DSA never looks at any election we participate in as just get one candidate over the top. We always look at it as an opportunity for deep organizing, for developing leadership within the organization, pulling more people into the organization. And our endorsements are incredibly, incredibly intensive. Any of the races I mentioned, there were dozens of DSA members who put tens or hundreds of hours into these campaigns, everything from phone banking to data entry to fundraising. And people complain that we haven't endorsed Biden. I think the question for us is, can Biden inspire that level of commitment from our volunteers? And the answer is no. He is not an inspiring candidate. So yeah, for us, endorsement is an incredibly high bar. We don't endorse a lot of candidates, including, you know, candidates we would love to see win, because we want to really focus our resources and go all in on the races that are most important to us.
I'm speaking with Michael Kanukin of DSA, Brooklyn's Electoral Working Group. This often put forward this fatuous opposition between electoral politics and real organizing. What you were just describing shows that that's not an opposition at all. But could you elaborate on that, the relation between organizing and electoral politics?
The capacity to build a strategic plan to win something within a time frame and then mobilize, you know, skills and organizing talent to get there is a skill that really has broad application in both electoral and non-electoral work. And, you know, one thing I've always been really, really excited about DSA's electoral work is every single cycle we develop dozens of new leaders who have really taken on responsibility for parts of the campaign, not just doing the basic repetitive work, but also developing plans, organizing. And every cycle we see that the people who come into the organization that way, when campaigns are over, they don't go away and wait for the next election. They get plugged into DSA's other work and sort of use those skills and that way of thinking and that commitment to leadership ID and leadership development to build our other campaigns. This cycle, we saw, in addition to the elections being run under conditions of COVID, they were also run while one of the biggest mass movements we've seen in my lifetime in the US sort of broke onto the scene. And both our candidates and most of the DSA people involved in our campaigns really actively participated in both. And I think there's a lot of excitement and energy around taking what we've built in these campaigns and moving it into campaigns like Defund the NYPD and making a count there.
Yeah, I hear some people saying that the explosion of that movement now has kind of left DSA behind. The leadership has moved elsewhere. Ross Douthat, of all people, is making this argument. What do you say to that?
DSA has always existed within a larger ecology of organizations and movements, and that's always been really valuable. There are organizations and movements with different social bases from ours that are complementary or different organizational structures as well. You know, what I've seen both in New York City and all across the country is that DSA members in literally the tens of thousands have participated in the protests and actions around Defund NYPD. DSA has not felt any need to sort of be the one calling the actions. We're very, very happy to provide support where the movement needs us. But the other thing I would say is, you know, I think a lot of people on the left, every time there's a cycle of mass protest, think somehow they expect that that cycle of mass protest will just sort of crest and crest and crest until it overthrows the structure of oppression it's devoted to opposing. But that's not how protest cycles work, right? Like Occupy Wall Street didn't just grow and grow and grow until the banks were put out of business or whatever. It cycled through a beginning, a crescendo, and then a decline as protests ran out of steam. And what came out of that was a ton of newly politicized people who had thought more deeply about what it would take to change society and went off and built organizations or did other things. My sense with DSA is that as we are really actively participating in this protest cycle, we're also buckling down for a longer term campaign here in New York. For instance, you know, Defund the NYPD is not going to be a campaign that ends in a week when the city council and the mayor agree on a budget. It's going to flow directly into next year. And a ton of DSA members are already thinking ahead on how to build the coalition and a movement to achieve that. I think that's true all over the country.
Yeah, I remember back during Occupy days, Fran Piven was saying that protests undergo a really long cycle over the course of many, many years. They ebb and flow, and you think, oh, it's over, and no, here it then again, it's reborn. She said that that characterized the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s. But it seems that cycle of protest that began with Occupy really has followed that model. It seems like it ebbed and flowed and continues to grow larger with each successive rebirth.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think one thing that's been really striking to me, having participated in the 2014-2015 Black Lives Matter surge and then watched this one play out, is that in so, so many ways, the left is better. It's better prepared. It's more strategic, more thoughtful, bigger, in a much better position to contest narrative hegemony or whatever, to put out its views in ways that are effective and persuasive. I've been very excited to sort of watch the progression from Occupy Wall Street to Black Lives Matter to Defund the Police as a process of really sharpening the demands and being more thoughtful about what we're asking for. After 2014 and 2015, there were a lot of liberal politicians who wanted to get credit for doing things like, you know, buying body cameras for their police forces or whatever, just you know, completely empty reforms. And I think the movement learned from that. It learned, you know, who controls the police, what scale of reform or opposition needs to be put in place to really change how policing is done. And now we're seeing across the country a really focused push to just move resources out of the incarceration and police system to shrink the whole thing rather than focusing on reforming it. And I find that really exciting.
Yeah, it's almost 10 years since Occupy. Well, I guess 9 years since Occupy popped on the scene. But we've come a long way from those days when agenda and organization were shunned or even scorned.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I just remember having arguments during Occupy where people were like, our strategy is literally to hold on to this park. That is our strategy. People had no context in terms of how to project power or what to ask for. And I think I was incessantly complaining about that at the time because I felt like, oh my God, we have this incredible moment when we have a national movement and we're going to miss the window because we can't put together good demands or because we don't have organization or whatever. And I think in retrospect, what I missed was it takes time to build organization, to build organizational discipline for millions of people to give themselves political education and understand how power works a little bit better. And the people who sort of were in Occupy and then Occupy went away, they didn't just disappear. They remained politicized and they thought about that experience and learned something from it. And I know I certainly did.
That was Michael Kanukin, a member of Brooklyn DSA's Electoral Working Group and an outstanding personality on political Facebook, which is how I got to know him. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Buried Treasure from the Mekons' new album, Exquisite. This song features Sally Timms and includes the only use of the word liminal I've come across in popular music. Till next week, bye.
Years 749, or it's 10 years ago.